Welcome to the podcast of Media Matters with Bob McChesney, a weekly show on media from WILL Radio. Visit us at will.uiuc.edu.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you on WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today, we're going to be talking to an expert on media coverage of environmental issues and also on media coverage of state suppression of dissent. It's going to be a terrific show, so please sit back, relax, and enjoy what's coming up. But first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
Legislation and initiatives addressing reforms to media and telecommunications policies are quickly piling up on Capitol Hill. Representative Ed Markey of Massachusetts, the new chairman of the House's Telecommunications Subcommittee, told attendees of the 2007 National Conference for Media Reform that the tone and substance of debates over such policies in D.C. has already changed. Using his newfound power, Markey pledged that congressional policy hearings will no longer be PR stunts for industry representatives alone, but will feature real discussion on what actually constitutes lawmaking in the public interest.
Unlike the last 2 years, it just won't be the CEOs of the telephone and the cable companies who are there. You will be selecting witnesses to testify right next to them on the same day before the same congressman, so the voices of the American people can be heard as well.
To that end, a new subcommittee has been established specifically to deal with issues of media reform under the auspices of the House's Committee on Government Reform. Chaired by Representative Dennis Kucinich of Ohio, the committee is expected to begin by grilling the Federal Communications Commission about its plans to further loosen media ownership regulations. On the Senate side, the Commerce Committee has already scheduled an interrogation of FCC commissioners for February 1st. Ed Markey plans to introduce a bill mirroring the Internet Freedom Preservation Act currently pending in the Senate. These, coupled with other legislation that would restore the fairness doctrine to TV and radio broadcasting, tighten caps on how much media one company can own, and open up unused spectrum for more community Wi-Fi broadband projects, signals a busy congressional session ahead.
Looking at the freedom to communicate more generally, there are some hopeful signs that Congress will take some steps in the right direction. The first Senate Judiciary Committee meeting of the new session took place on January 17th, and senators from both sides of the aisle pledged to take a closer look at how the government has been using wiretaps and other means of surveillance to keep tabs on the U.S. population. Senators expressed consternation over the revelation that at least four dozen federal agencies are engaged in some 200 different data mining programs, one of which has amassed more than 1 million records on American citizens who have never been formally charged with any crime. They also didn't seem happy with a presidential statement written into the margins of postal legislation signed into law late last year that conceivably gives a U.S. Postal Service the right to intercept and read our mail without the need for a warrant. However, even with the shift in power on Capitol Hill, the debates expected to take place will not all result in laws that better represent the public interest when it comes to our media environment. For example, the music and movie industries have already begun a blitz to expand copyright laws in hopes of locking down media content in creative new ways. A bill recently introduced in the Senate would effectively stop consumers from recording specific songs and shows off of digital radio and satellite television systems. Such a move would destroy the time-honored and fair use-backed practice of time shifting, where people are allowed to selectively record content for personal use at a time most convenient to them. Time shifting lies at the heart of devices such as VCRs and digital video recorders like TiVo, and the impact of this proposal on those devices is unclear. Unfortunately, this one bill has more bipartisan support than all the rest of the more promising, positive legislation pending in the House or Senate.
Changing the face of media policy from the top down also contains further challenges, like how to clean up the Federal Communications Commission. According to the Nonpartisan Center for Responsive Politics, the FCC is the third largest supplier of so-called revolving door employees, people who work in government for a short time before heading off to cushy jobs lobbying for the industries they used to regulate, ranking only behind the House of Representatives and White House in this regard. What's more, the somewhat secretive culture of the FCC remains to be fully penetrated. Over the New Year's holiday, the agency responded to a Freedom of Information Act request relating to studies used in the FCC's past and present reviews of media ownership rules. While a slew of documents and data were released, the FCC's elected to keep secret more than 1,400 pages of information, including certain drafts of media ownership reports that are already publicly available in other forms. The FCC claimed these documents were exempted from the FOIA request because they either directly relate to current ongoing deliberations over media ownership or contain industry trade secrets, but there's no way to verify those excuses without taking the matter to court. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, on WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today, we've got a topic that I think is going to interest a lot of our listeners. We've had a lot of requests for both the subjects we're going to be concentrating upon, environmental issues, the press coverage of them, and also civil liberties issues, issues of dissent in our society and how they're treated by the media, they're covered, and suppression of dissent specifically. Our guest is a professor of political science from Pacific University, author of a couple of new books, including The Suppression of Dissent, published by Routledge last year in 2006. His name is Jules Boykoff. Jules, welcome to Media Matters.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you, and we've got some great stuff to cover. And I just want to let our listeners know right now that we pre-recorded this show before going on air. So don't call in today. Sit back, relax, let us do the yakking. And enjoy yourselves, because there's a lot to talk about. Let's talk about the environment and global warming for a while first, and the press coverage of it. This is an issue that a lot of our listeners have wanted to hear a program on. We haven't really had a chance to cover it anywhere near the detail I wanted. First, you know, your work has been used and cited by people like Al Gore. It's been used at UN conferences. What is the nature of the environmental problems surrounding global warming? And then in your view, having said that, what's the nature of the U.S. press coverage of the issue?
Sure. Well, I think, first of all, that global warming is the biggest crisis that faces us today. It's a moral crisis, and it's a serious environmental crisis, obviously. And I've done research with my brother, Maxwell Boykoff, who's currently housed at Oxford University over in England in the Environmental Change Institute. And he and I did a longitudinal, which is to say a long overtime study from 1988 through 2002 on how the U.S. press covers global warming. And so what we did was we looked at what we call the prestige press, which is the Los Angeles Times, New York Times, Washington Post, and Wall Street Journal. And we collected all the articles on global warming that were published by those four newspapers, and we were looking at the norm of balanced reporting, which is to say telling both sides of the stories, which is often held up as a traditional pillar of good journalism, and people are taught in journalism school, adhere to balance, this is a good thing. But our hypothesis was that when it comes to global warming, balancing those who say it's real, yes, and humans are causing it, yes, against those who say that it's not real, a handful of skeptics, many of whom are funded by ExxonMobil and other oil interests, that balance is actually a form of informational bias or informational distortion. So we went into our study wondering if, in fact, we had balance, which is to say bias. And we found that overwhelmingly the articles were, in fact, balanced, balancing the independent scientists from around the world, top climate change scientists who publish in peer-reviewed journals, balancing them against these handful of skeptics who are saying, actually, global warming's not a big deal. And these gentlemen and a few women do not publish in peer-reviewed journals and actually publish in a number of places that are funded by carbon-based interests. And so in that 14, 15-year time period, we found that 53% of the articles that appeared in those four publications were in fact balancing those. And it was statistically significant between 1990 and 2002. Now, I sort of harp on that, it being statistically significant from 1990 to 2002, because it wasn't really until 1989, 1990, when the global warming skeptics started to fire on all cylinders. And that was because they started to be funded by places like the George C. Marshall Institute, which publishes reports, I should say not scientific peer-reviewed studies, but reports that critiqued the climate change models that were being put forth by these independent peer-reviewed scientists. And also you had the formation in 1989 of something called the Global Climate Coalition, basically a coalition of oil interests and other carbon interests that lobbied to try to make it seem as if global warming wasn't happening. And they were in operation starting in 1989. And these two groups, among others, started to fund a coherent and cohesive group of scientists who emerged to challenge these claims that were made and these reports that were being put forth by this eminent UN body called the IPCC, which stands for Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And so you had these sort of extremist scientists funded by these groups and other groups, people like S. Fred Singer, Don Perlman, Richard Lindzen, Sally Baliunas, Robert Balling Jr., Patrick Michaels, names that started to get a lot of press as global warming skeptics balanced against these people that were saying it was real and we need to do something about it.
Well, Jules Bookup, I want to just go back to the very first point you made about you think global warming is the most serious issue facing humanity today.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not an expert at this, but you know, I'll be honest, sometimes I avoid global warming stories because they are so depressing, because it seems like if you follow the story closely, and I'm not necessarily talking about the ones that you've been chronicling, but ones by serious scientists and observers, it's hard to avoid the conclusion that unless we make dramatic changes in what we do in the world, the end road for this is the extinction of our species. I mean, it just seems pretty much that's what it's all about eventually.
That's true. And that's why I say that I think it's the biggest problem facing us today. And it interweaves with other problems that the general public really do think are important problems, such as the war in Iraq. I mean, the use of fossil fuels, which contributes to global warming, obviously is a big part in why the United States is over in Iraq right now and in the Middle East more generally. So a lot of these really important issues are intertwined. But if the United States were to do those drastic measures, And serious measures need to be taken, you're right. Within the next 10 years or so, we need to start cutting back our expulsion of carbon into the atmosphere and greenhouse gases more generally. We do need to do that soon, and I think that's why I'm saying it in these stark terms, because we really do need to collectively start to act on this.
Do you think these articles that present sort of what you call sort of a phony balance on the issue, presenting sort of the corporate-funded spin as being sort of an equal or close equal footing with the scientific opinion, which is virtually unanimous in the world on the issue. Do you think this has an effect on public opinion? It has an effect on the way people understand the issue?
I do think it does affect the way it's talked about in public, that's for sure. I mean, by having this balance, you create a situation where politicians can feel free to say the mantra of more research rather than actually having to do something about it. What I'm saying is it affords a certain pockets of political space for the politicians to basically not do anything about it and just call for more research. At the same time, though, you're asking about public opinion, and public opinion's pretty strong that people want to do something about global warming. I mean, there was a recent NBC News Wall Street Journal poll that found that 59% of those surveyed believed that action needed to be taken to combat global warming, and then a majority told Gallup that protection of the environment should be given priority, even if it might hamper economic growth. I think that's pretty striking that more than half of the population polled in the United States think that we should protect the environment, even if it might hamper economic growth. So I think now the public is willing to move on it. I think what it needs is some political will. I personally believe that politicians now have plenty of backing from the public to take some action on it. So I'll be interested to see what this new Congress does in 2007.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Jules Boykoff, professor of political science at Pacific University out in, what town in Oregon is that in?
We're in Forest Grove, just west of Portland.
Just west of Portland. Jules Boykoff is the author of the books The Suppression of Dissent, published by Routledge in 2006, and the author of many articles on press coverage of environmental issues, specifically global warming. You know, you talked about how the professional canon of balance is used in these stories on global warming to present a very misleading impression that there's some sort of legitimate debate on global warming, when in fact, among people who actually study this who aren't paid off by polluters, there is no debate. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the situation is growing worse. I don't think there's any question about the veracity of what I just said. But what's interesting to me is how do they decide when balance gets applied? I mean, you look at stories about the Holocaust, and I don't think that the New York Times or Washington Post says, well, that's one view. Now here's David Duke's opinion of the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. To balance it, you've got to understand this position. When they do stories on Hugo Chavez, they don't say, well, we better stop, or Fidel Castro, they say, well, here's the favorable side of what's going on in Venezuela or Cuba to contrast with the critical positions that our government officials are saying. I mean, how does that decision come into play that a story is made, this one gets balanced and this one doesn't?
Right. Well, some people have talked about making the distinction between opinions in which there should be balance and facts, hard scientific facts, in which really there should not be balance in that case. But I would just say, you know, stepping back, that the study that my brother Max and I did on this is definitely not meant as some kind of personal attack on individual journalists. In fact, really adhering to the norm of balance is a sign of professional journalism. And in fact, a lot of people actually get the story right, including a gentleman who writes for the New York Times named Andrew Revkin. So really, our critique is more of an institutional critique to question the professional norms and practices of this mass media system.
But my question, Jules, is, you know, why this norm isn't always applied. You know, they don't balance Hitler. They don't say, you know, and here's the other, the favorable side to what Hitler did or to the Holocaust. I mean, it's only applied. Why is it this is the story that gets it, and Hugo Chavez isn't balanced with stories about what a great job he's doing for poor people in Venezuela?
Right, and you don't have pro-capitalist positions balanced against positions
capitalism. Yeah, you don't have, like, socialists giving their critique of the economy when you have stories lauding economic growth or some investment. So,
mm-hmm. I mean, well, actually, I think it does go to capitalism in a sense, and what I mean by that is neoliberal capitalism, the era that we're living in, marked by deregulation, privatization. And what that does in the media industry, as you well know, is that it leads to downsizing of people. You don't have people doing investigative journalism. You have people who are specialists in certain areas that are forced to be generalists. So, like, let's say you're an expert on South American frogs or something, and then you get asked to cover global warming because you're kind of the science writer. Well, when that happens, which is often the case with neoliberal capitalism that's sort of pressing and forcing downsizing, then you have people relying on this norm of balance because, hey, they're not climate change specialists. They're not global warming specialists. And so they use balance in that sense as a crutch. And so that's one of the reasons, really, mm-hmm. I think, why it happens on the ground, in the real world, in the newsrooms. It's just the downsizing leads to people using balance as a crutch.
What are some of the other big environmental issues, in addition to global warming, that, in your view, should be in the news media, that should be getting attention from the general population, that are of importance to the citizens of this country?
Yeah, well, I mean, I focus on global warming with my brother, but I think that a number of related issues are also really important in terms of deforestation, for example, which is tied to global warming, in terms of the fact that the fish are being depleted in our seas and oceans at an alarming rate where we might not even have edible fish around by halfway through the next century. These things should be on the table and should be discussed every day, really, in the media, and we should be thinking about solutions for how to deal with them in the short and long term.
How important, in the case of global warming and really in these other environmental issues, in sort of warping the coverage with the use of balance, is predicated on the notion that there are powerful industries subsidizing think tanks and experts to produce this balance? I mean, if there weren't powerful industries that benefit by the status quo funding these so-called experts, mm-hmm. there wouldn't be any balance, would there? I mean, that the coverage wouldn't make any pretense of giving some phony professor equality with legitimate scholarly opinion, would they?
Right. No, I do think you have to point to factors like that. I mean, the oil and coal industries have consistently offered hefty campaign contributions to these national politicians that I mentioned before who have been largely inactive. These industries have a well-connected cadre of lobbyists who are working night and day on Capitol Hill. We can't overlook the Bush administration's longstanding relationship with the energy industries. You can't overlook the crew. I think this is another important point, actually, is there's a certain disjuncture between a scientific community that speaks in a language of uncertainty and probability. That's just the way scientists talk. Mm-hmm. And there's a disjuncture between that and a political culture in the United States that insists that if it's not 100% certain, that's not even 10% real. So there's just a certain disjuncture in the way that scientists and politicians talk. And that, too, is a factor that plays into why we have this balanced coverage. Because really, by the way scientists talk, in terms of uncertainties and probabilities, it wedges open a little bit of doubt. Not that there should be doubt, but just by the language that's used, it wedges open doubt, and in come this small group of skeptics to widen that wedge.
Now, Jules Boykoff, in your research, have you had a chance to look at the press systems, the elite press, in other nations, in Europe and Latin America and Asia, to see how they're covering global warming, to get a sense, are they having the same sense of balance and the sort of corporate interests getting the same representation mm-hmm. as legitimate, or is that primarily a U.S. phenomenon?
Well, that's a really great question. And
hey, that's why they pay me the big bucks.
Well, I was just over in Nairobi recently speaking at the United Nations Conference on Climate Change, and after the talk that I gave on this very topic, I had people from other countries, primarily in Western Europe and moving towards Central Europe, coming to me just totally flabbergasted, like, what are you talking about? Yeah, we might have talked like this a little bit, like in the 80s, but we're pretty much over it now. But my brother, Max, who I've mentioned, and he's over at the University of Oxford in England, he's actually carrying out rigorous systematic analysis that asks that very question, comparing how the U.S. covers global warming to how the English newspapers cover global warming. So it'll be interesting to see what he comes up with. But his hypothesis, I'm sure, is that it's going to be a little bit different.
Yeah, that would be my sense, too, but I'll be very interested to see that research. You know, one of the things that people always ask me on this issue, and I have students and we talk about it in class, is they say, you know, look, these people who benefit by the status quo, the polluters and the companies that make money with the practices that are doing so much damage to the environment, I mean, are the people who own these companies, are they planning to, like, take a rocket ship to live on Mars in 50 years? What, at some point, don't they realize being a gazillionaire and being extinct is less fun than being a millionaire and living?
Well, you would think that they would have that flitting through their mind, but unfortunately, short-term profit is much more important to a lot of these people than thinking about those kind of long-term questions.
Well, I guess the classic line, "In the long run, we'll all be dead."
Perhaps.
I guess they're gonna definitely make that the short run, possibly too.
Right.
Our guest today, Jules Boykoff, professor of political science at Pacific University, expert on press coverage of global warming, and also the author of a fairly new book, "The Suppression of Dissent," published by Routledge in 2006. And this year, 2007, you've got another book out, right, Jules, called "Beyond Bullets."
That's right, "Beyond Bullets: The Suppression of Dissent in the United States."
So you've been doing a lot of writing about dissent and dissent movements in the United States and globally, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. And let's talk about that. Let's turn to that if we can at this point. Let me remind listeners again, this is a pre-recorded show. We went on air shortly before. We taped this shortly before going on air. So please don't call in today. Sit back, relax. Let Jules and me do the yakking. Let's talk now about your book, "The Suppression of Dissent." What stoked your interest in this? Is this related to your global warming work, or is this a different hat you're wearing? And what got you into this?
Yeah, this is definitely a different hat that I'm wearing here. And what really got me into it was I was reading all sorts of things about repression and suppression of dissent in other countries, and I wasn't seeing as much in the United States. And so I kind of started to dig into it a little bit because I had this hunch that, in fact, there was suppression of dissent going on in the United States, and I wanted to sort of figure out really the ways in which it happened. So that's kind of how it all started, was just curious about the sort of modes of suppression, what I call in the books the modes of suppression that the state and mass media engage in. In other words, the actions that the state and mass media take to suppress dissent. And so it kind of started with just wondering why it wasn't being talked about that much.
Well, I mean, I think the conventional wisdom is that there isn't any suppression of dissent. This is a free country, unlike all these other places like around the world where suppression of dissent is routine because they don't enjoy our Constitution. Here in the United States, that simply doesn't really take place except for an aberrant goofball sheriff in some place like Mississippi periodically.
Right. I think what you're putting your finger on there is that people think that we have these longstanding traditions of tolerance, longstanding traditions of inclusion, of democracy. And the fact, though, really is that dissident citizens and social movements have historically experienced significant and sustained suppression in this country, although often this suppression is subtle and it's difficult to observe.
Yeah, but okay, fine. The abolitionists faced it. The socialists did in the Palmer Raids after World War I. Maybe, you know, some actors did in Hollywood in the 1950s. But that's all ancient history, isn't it?
Yeah, if only it were. And so that's kind of what I do in these books is I focus on the 20th century and 21st century and look at a number of individual dissident citizens as well as social movements to try to figure out how they were suppressed by the state. And I find that, in fact, it wasn't just isolated incidents like you're referring to, the Palmer Raids or during World War II with McCarthyism and communists, but actually it extends all the way forth to our present moment.
How, Jules Bukoff, what would you characterize as the main forms of dissent in our society that are facing suppression by the state? And then after that, we'll talk a little bit about the media. Let's just talk about the state right now.
Sure. Well, I mean, in the book that you mentioned, I mean, I break it down into 12 ways in which the state and mass media suppress dissent. So 12 modes of suppression. 8 of them are related to the state, and 4 of them are related to the mass media. And I start off just talking about the one that is probably the most obvious and glaring, and that is direct violence. And I call that repression with an R, and I distinguish that from suppression, which are all these other modes. But anyways, direct violence, it's been a long tradition of that, actually, in this country, including not too far from where you are, Bob, up in Chicago, when Fred Hampton, a young leader of the Black Panther Party, was killed in his bed on the 4th of December, 1969. And so there are a number of cases of direct violence. Look, not that long ago in Seattle when the police brought out the tear gas and batons and inflicted punishment on the dissident citizens protesting the WTO or the World Trade Organization. So that's one of the state methods of suppression that I talk about. But, I mean, the reason why I'm calling this book that I'm doing with AK Press, the reason I'm calling it Beyond Bullets is because there's so many other forms of suppression beyond just the obvious bullet and baton. And so other forms are, say, surveillance and break-ins. And so I have a chapter on how the FBI surveilled Martin Luther King Jr. over time and how that changed, the goal of the surveillance changed. I talk about infiltration of social movements by fakes, basically, by phonies, by informants who are then turning and giving information to local police or the FBI. I talk about a phenomenon called badjacketing, which is when an informant infiltrates into a social movement and then paints one of the legitimate members as an actual informant. So it's sort of a spurious turn of reverse psychology where a legitimate member of the group is painted by the illegitimate member as a snitch when in fact the opposite is
sort of like the movie Stalag 17 with William Holden.
I don't know that particular film. I'll have to check it out.
Yeah, you'll have to.
And so there's other forms as well. I mean, just harassment, general harassment and harassment arrests constitute another one of these methods of suppression. Also, extraordinary rules and laws I have as a category. And so I talk about the many extraordinary rules and laws, including, actually, I consider the Patriot Act to be quite extraordinary in many of its tenets. And so I do an analysis, a critical analysis of the Patriot Act and certain provisions that are perhaps the most important in terms of suppressing dissent.
Is there a pattern, Jules Bukoff, to the sort of people or groups that are being suppressed? I mean, is there just a random selection across our society, or are there certain groups that are routinely being monitored and suppressed in our society?
Mm-hmm. Groups that are posing significant challenges, as you might suspect, are those that usually get the most attention from the state. And so you had in the late 1960s, the Black Power movement in the United States had tons of people on board and tons of adherents, many different groups. And, of course, they were attracting a lot of attention from the FBI and other law enforcement agencies. And you even had in that same time period what was called, not as much talked about, but a really important movement, the Red Power movement of Native Americans. and a group called the American Indian Movement that was heavily suppressed. Incredible stories of what happened with the FBI trying to squelch this movement. So today you've got people that are anti-capitalists getting heavily surveilled, anarchists who are anti-capitalists. So I guess what I'm saying is...
Well, are these people breaking the laws? Or are these a lot of these groups law-abiding groups that aren't or that are just critical of capitalism order? Or are these groups that are actually plotting to rob banks and stuff?
Well, I think it's really a mixture of both, Bob. I mean, you do definitely have totally above-board legal groups engaging in completely legal activity who are attracting attention. And then you have groups, say, the Weather Underground, or groups like the Earth Liberation Front, who are operating now, who are engaging in violence. Like the Earth Liberation Front's a big deal here in Oregon, where there are a number of indictments have been and brought down, and people have actually been now convicted of charges related to Earth Liberation Front activities. Basically, this group, for those that aren't familiar with it, is a radical environmental group that has done a number of arsons, including an arson at Vail, at the ski resort in Vail, Colorado. They've also blown up SUVs in a parking lot in Oregon here. I should probably point out, though, I mean, to break down violence, I mean, they've only carried out violence against things like cars and developments. No one's actually been hurt. That is not to be said for other groups that have been acting before, where people have, in fact, gotten hurt before. So you've got groups like these that are doing illegal things. Like, I mean, I guess you might say that the Earth Liberation Front is engaged in sort of extremist vandalism, perhaps, although that's definitely not the way that the state is portraying it. I mean, these are domestic terrorists of the worst order, according to the state, the most dangerous domestic terrorism group in the United States, actually. So you've got groups like that that are in fact breaking the laws. It's not legal, obviously, to blow up SUVs in a parking lot. But you've also got groups that are doing totally legal activities. I mean, look at a lot of the groups operating in the global justice movement, by which I mean a loose coalition of movements operating today, many of them challenging neoliberal capitalism, a lot of them fighting for environmental causes, a lot of them fighting for gender-related issues. And so they've come together. They're totally legal. They're part of 501c3 organizations, and yet they're finding themselves infiltrated. Look, after September 11th, a number of peace groups from Denver to Sacramento to elsewhere in the country who've been infiltrated by local police and FBI. And so these groups aren't doing anything illegal. They're eating cookies and sitting around and plotting plans for legal, law-abiding protests in their communities, and they're also coming into this vortex of suppression.
Jules Boykoff, our guest today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Jules Boykoff is a professor of political science at Pacific University out in Oregon, the author of a couple of books, The Suppression of Assent, published by Routledge last year, and a new book, Beyond Bullets, published by AK Press this year, 2007. This is a pre-recorded show, so please do not call in. Sit back, relax, and let us talk about the issues of the day, which are primarily the press coverage of media policy, specifically global warming, and now what we're talking about, how dissent is framed in the media, or specifically the suppression of dissent as well, a subject Jules Boykoff has written on widely and studied closely. Jules, I was thinking while you were talking just now about the urban legend that the Communist Party in the 1950s in the United States only could survive and stay in business, so to speak, or stay open because something like a third or half of its dues-paying members were government agents.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of provided the funds it needed to even remain in existence. So totally had the government infiltrated the Communist Party at that time. And what I was wondering is, we've seen in the past decade or two noticeable increase in extra-legal activity on the political right, militias,
mm-hmm.
White supremacist groups that have been organizing with guns and engaging in terrorist activities towards people of color and women and other groups, gays and lesbians. Are these groups also being monitored closely by the state? Is it in addition to groups that are like the environmentalists, radical environmentalists, or the global justice movement?
Well, as far as I can tell, yes, they are. Although, if you look historically at the groups that were monitored by, say, the FBI, it's overwhelmingly groups of the left. I should probably take a step back and inject a term into the discussion that I think is really important, not just for history, but also for thinking about our present. And that's the idea of COINTELPRO, which is an acronym actually that stands for Counterintelligence Programs. And this was a series of programs run by the FBI from 1956 to 1971. And they really had five targeted groups, the Communist Party USA, the Socialist Workers Party, and to get to what you're saying, white hate groups. There was a white hate group target within COINTELPRO. There was also the Black Nationalist Hate Group Program, which sort of ironically under the Black Nationalist Hate Group Program, Martin Luther King Jr. was considered a part of a Black Nationalist Hate Group with the SCLC, Southern Christian Leadership Conference. And then the fifth group that they looked at was the New Left Program. So if you look at just those five COINTELPROs, you see that four out of the five are groups on the left. And that's pretty indicative of the general picture when it comes to suppression. Now, that's not to say that white hate groups are not looked at contemporarily or historically, but it does seem to be that the left gets a lot more attention.
Well, let's talk now about media coverage. First of all, this is the media, how they cover dissident groups in the news media, and then talk about how the government's activities towards these groups is covered. But just in general, if you could say a few words about how dissent is framed in the U.S. news media. What's your findings there?
Sure. Well, as I mentioned before, I point to four main ways in which the mass media act that have the effect of suppressing dissent. And the first of those is what I call mass media manipulation. And I break that down really into two types. One is this notion of sort of story implantation, where basically, let's say the FBI writes a story and gives it to a friendly press contact who then basically publishes it verbatim. And so the state's kind of planting stories via friendly press contacts. And an example of this actually goes back to COINTELPRO, the counterintelligence programs I just mentioned, where the Bureau, the FBI, used friendly media contacts to basically besmirch the names of individual dissidents, such as someone named Jean Seberg, who was an actress.
Yeah, a famous actress at the time.
Yeah, a famous actress living over in France. And she basically had given about $10,000 to the Black Panther Party, and the FBI knew this because they were surveilling her bank accounts, and they wanted to put a stop to this, all this support. And so they were actually monitoring a conversation that she was having with somebody, and they found out that, in fact, she was pregnant. And so the FBI had this grand idea that they would use this information at a later date to besmirch her reputation by faking that Jean Seberg was pregnant by a member of the Black Panther Party, when in fact she wasn't, nor actually was she pregnant by her husband, Roman Gary. And sort of, if you'll forgive me for a little People magazine political science moment here, she was actually pregnant from a guy in Mexico she was in a film with called Macho Callahan down there. In any case, they had the information, and they saved it for the proper moment later, and they released it to a friendly contact in the press. It was first published in the Los Angeles Times that she was pregnant by a Black Panther, although it didn't name Jean Seberg by name. That was then picked up by a Hollywood journal and ultimately made its way into places like Newsweek, where they actually did name Jean Seberg's name. And she got tremendously stressed out by these rumors that were spreading in now mainstream media sources about her. She ended up, because of the stress in part, giving birth to the baby early through a cesarean section. The baby was like 4 pounds only when it was born, died a couple days later, plunging Seberg into a massive depression. She ends up trying to commit suicide every year, roughly around the time that the baby died, and ultimately is successful. She overdoses on barbiturates in 1979. So you can sort of see how these actions, story implantation, can kind of play out in a really ugly way through time. The other example of mass media manipulation I talk about is this idea of journalistic strong-arming. And Lyndon Johnson was famous for this. If he didn't like what he heard on the news, he would call that person right up and give him a piece of his mind. Things I definitely can't say on your radio show here. He would call Dan Rather in the middle of a show to refute, correct, or applaud information that he was presented, or that was being presented by Rather. In fact, actually, Morley Safer did a critical story on Vietnam for CBS, and he called Frank Sutton, Lyndon Johnson called Frank Sutton and just said all these expletives about what Morley Safer was doing, then ran a background check on him because he was Canadian. And so that's one way it happens, mass media manipulation, direct manipulation by state agents. A second way that I talk about in the book is something that I coined called bi-level demonization. And what I mean by bi-level demonization is a process whereby you've got an external foe out there in the international arena who's being demonized by the press. Say Saddam Hussein, say communists in the mid-century in the United States, say terrorists today. And what's done is the domestic dissident group is linked to this external demon, either rightly or wrongly, it doesn't matter if it's correct or not, and linked to the demon based on ideology, based on ethnicity, based on race, or some other category. And so I argue in the book that basically bi-level demonization was the ideological foundation upon which McCarthyism was built, so linking domestic dissidents to foreign communists. And I think now what we see more than that, of course, with the downfall of the Soviet Union, is that we have dissidents more likely to be linked with terrorism than communism. And I mentioned the ELF, the Earth Liberation Front, as an example of that. A third way that the media suppress dissent is through something I call mass media deprecation. And that's getting at the framing that you were mentioning. How are dissidents framed or described, really, in the news? And oftentimes, more often than I might even expected going in, the media portray dissidents who engage in contentious politics and in dissident citizenship as ridiculous. They portray them as bizarre, sometimes dangerous, and definitely out of step with sort of middle U.S. America. And so I did a study on how the global justice movement actually was covered by mainstream press in Seattle in 1999, as well as Washington, D.C., at the protests against the World Bank and the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, in April of 2000. And I looked to see what the main frames were that were used to cover these groups. And so I came up with the idea of the violence frame, like these are violent dissidents, the disruption frame, that they're disrupting things for just good old law-abiding citizens, the freak frame, where they highlight on people's appearances and tattoos and piercings and hair color at the expense of covering their grievances. Also an ignorance frame where dissidents are portrayed as ignorant. So I kind of do an analysis of that global justice movement. And then the last way that I talk about in the book is underestimation of crowds. And we all know how important it is for crowds to be large for these dissident citizens, and how that can actually help create momentum for a movement when you get a huge turnout at an event. And what we find, or what I found in my research, was that basically the media tend to conform to state estimates of crowd size as opposed to the dissident estimates. And there's almost always huge discrepancies between the two, but a reliance on the state. Also, this notion of false balance, and I guess there's a touching point with the stuff we were talking about before, and falsely balancing dissidents against counter-protesters, say. And this can be done visually. I've seen photographs, and probably many of your listeners have too, in the paper where it looks as if there's 20 dissidents facing off against 20 counter-protesters or something. And if you could only widen the frame of the picture, you'd see that behind the 20 dissident citizens, you've got like 100,000 other ones, and behind the 20 counter-protesters waving their flags or something, there's nobody. And so it gives this false sense of balance within the frame of the photograph. But it can also happen within story and between story. What I mean by that is when there's a story about some kind of dissident action, they also talk about the counter-protesters, even though, not unlike the global warming scenario, the counter-protesters are much smaller in number than the protesters themselves. And then sometimes it's done between story, where you have, okay, let's be fair, give one story to the dissidents and one story to the counter-protesters, again, even though there's many more dissidents at the protest. And then the last way that I talk about is disregard. Just, you know, ignore them and don't give them press coverage, even if it's a huge protest of 100,000 people, even if it's a protest that takes place in 100 cities across the country. And one way that I noticed the Washington Post does this is not just total disregard, but something that I call relative disregard, where they place the stories about these big marches that are happening in Washington, D.C., they place them in the metro section. After all, they did happen in the D.C. metro area, rather than on the front page of the paper. They bury them in a lower section, and often in a back page of a lower section. So those are many of the ways that I've come across in my research that the media tend to portray dissent in not necessarily positive fashion.
Yeah, Jules Boykoff, I'd like to talk about that last one because, excuse me again, because, You know, I recall, you know, back in the late 60s and early 70s that there were enormous demonstrations against the Vietnam War. And sometimes they're drawing 500,000 people to Washington, D.C., the mobilizations in that period, which I can safely say I was around at that time. And they were enormous news stories. I mean, it was like if you lived in this country and you turned on your television or picked up a newspaper, you knew about these events. They were impossible to avoid. And Todd Gitlin wrote a famous book called The Whole World is Watching. That was published around 1980, which was basically about how the new left and the anti-war organizers understood they were getting media coverage, and it really, you know, they understood how important it was to conveying their message, and they used this relationship with the media almost to determine, as a social movement, what sort of actions they would take. I mean, it was central to their planning, this relationship. It strikes me your last point gets at something that is really the salient factor, at least from my experience, which is the amount of actual coverage of dissidents has just plummeted. It isn't a news story anymore. It is buried. The bar to get coverage is much higher, to put it another way. To the threshold that dissidents need to meet to be justified as a legitimate news story to get the same attention they got 30, 40 years ago is considerably higher. Is your research show that, or am I just missing something?
No, I think you're right, and I think it points to a few things. One is just that protest in the form of mass demonstrations has essentially become institutionalized. There's nothing surprising about it. You're getting a permit for it. It's basically a state-sanctioned form of dissent, and it's one that's been around for a long, long time. And so given the fact that the media have this sort of unquenchable penchant for novelty, this story doesn't really fit it. It's not novel. We've seen these protests that you are actually talking about from the 1960s, and so this isn't really necessarily anything new. I mean, there's that. I think, you know, in terms of what you're talking about with Gitlin, it points to this sort of what I call in my work, and maybe I call it the dialectic of escalation, which is basically kind of a multisyllabic fancy way of saying that dissidents are responding to these tendencies that they see in the media, this unquenchable penchant for novelty, for example. And the dissidents engage in novel acts, creative acts, that sort of verge toward acts that could be easily made fun of. But you have to do something different in this age of institutionalized protest to get the attention of the media, and it can be a really fine line to walk. So you see what I mean? You have to engage in creative protest to get the attention of the media, but at the same time, you open yourself up to being deprecated or made to look silly by those very media that you're trying to interact with. And I think Gitlin's right. I mean, the new left, and I know what book you're talking about, he critiques them for being maybe a little bit too much in tune with worrying about the press. But let's face it, today you have to get media coverage for your movement if you want your ideas to get out at all. The trick is to get the media's attention without having them deprecate you or just focus on you and your appearance and your puppets and whatnot at the expense of actually talking about why you're on the streets in the first place.
You know, one of the other developments, Jules Boykoff, that's taken place with dissident social movements in the United States in the past 5 or 10 years has been the emergence of what are called free speech zones, which happened, for example, in the 2004 Republican Convention. And it's happened for some of the trade meetings that you've talked about, where people are allowed to protest. They're given permits to protest, but they're given permits not to be very close to the actual event, but they're put several blocks away so that, you know, they're allowed to protest, but they're on the other side of town.
Right.
And this is, you know, to me, a very sort of interesting phenomenon. That's probably the most polite term I can use for it.
Right.
And is this something that you've factored in as how this affects press coverage?
I have. I mean, I've looked, first of all, at these amazing free speech zones. I mean, I thought the whole United States was actually a free speech zone, but these are amazing examples of extraordinary rules that are being put forth for dissidents. I mean, literally, you've seen these things. They look like cages. And so then when you take a picture, if you're in the press and you're taking pictures of these dissident citizens, it looks like they're in pens, as if they're dangerous criminals behind bars. And I mean, that only gives off the impression that these dissidents are engaged in criminal behavior and need to be penned up behind bars. But so that's part of how it's covered in the media. I've actually seen some good critical stories in the press, though, about these so-called free speech zones. And so I'm a little bit hopeful with that. But this is something, as you said, over the last or 10 maybe years, but really especially, I have to say, under the Bush administration, where anybody who's engaging in any dissent gets sort of pushed away from the parade route or pushed away from the Republican National Convention in New York, as happened in 2004, and like you say, pushed off out into the distance. Sure, you can jump up and down and hold your signs, but we won't even get close to you, we being like President Bush or Dick Cheney or whomever, whatever important bigwigs from the Republican Party. So, yeah, you've put your finger on something that's ongoing and that the Bush administration has made use of throughout its tenure.
You know, Jules Boykoff, I might sort of disagree slightly with something you said earlier about the importance of demonstrations being primarily to get press coverage, you get popular awareness of the issue. I think that is certainly one part of it. But the other part of it is the idea that's built into one of the five. There are two protections of the First Amendment. There are five protections overall in the First Amendment: speech, religion, press. But the other two are the right to assemble and the right to redress grievances against the state. And you know, when people protest at the Republican or Democratic convention, it's not merely to get attention from the media, but it's also to let people in power understand there are lots of people who want their grievances understood. Mm-hmm. When you have these free speech zones, it seems like you basically wipe out two of the five parts of the First Amendment because you can, you know, people can go to the Republican convention and never know these demonstrations take place because they're 20 blocks away. And the media can avoid them too because 20 blocks away, you got to go out of your way to find the cage.
Right. Yeah, no, I think you're right. I mean, it definitely plays into the way that the media cover it if they can find it at all. I mean, I don't know if I would necessarily say that getting media attention is the primary thing. I mean, there's a whole lot more going on with social movements than just getting media attention. I mean, I talk about, in my work, I talk about what I see as the crucial conditions to be successful in your collective action, and only one of those is to generate media coverage, hopefully positive, for your movement. And the others are, like, maintain solidarity among your people you're working with, attract new recruits to your cause. Another one is to create, nurture and support leaders and leadership more generally. And then a fifth one is to try to mobilize support from potentially sympathetic bystanders, whether they're in the corridors of power, such as people in Congress or local politicians, or outside the corridors of power. So I think we're on the same page. I mean, I think that it's important to generate media coverage, but also with these actions, there's so much more, both symbolically, just for standing up for our rights, but also strategically in terms of these things I'm talking about.
You know, Jules, I've got friends who think this is a really like horse and buggy discussion we're having, or 19th, 20th century discussion. They say, look at Move On, look at the Internet. All the things that demonstrations once did can now be done digitally, and the government can't repress those. We've gone past the point where the cops can come break heads and keep us quiet, and we can organize and reach people much less expensively. We don't have to wait for the New York Times or CBS News to cover a demonstration. We can reach out to people directly via the Internet. That really makes these concerns antiquated, if not entirely irrelevant, and the tools that people now have are vastly more powerful for doing dissident political work, and they're very difficult for the state to repress, if not impossible. I suspect you've heard arguments along these lines.
I have.
And what's your response?
Well, I disagree, actually. I think the Internet is a great place to get information, and it's a great place to pass along information, and it's a great place to supplement dissident boots-on-the-pavement activity. But I don't think it's just can be a wholehearted replacement for actually getting out in the real world and looking face-to-face with people and locking arms in solidarity and actually doing something, whether it's a protest like we've been talking about or some other creative action or guerrilla theater or anything. So I think it's more of a supplement than a replacement. And I worry a little bit about people that feel like by pressing a couple things on their keyboard that they are being good dissidents and that's all they need to do. While I think it's important work, and shoot, I send off emails all the time to my representatives and to others on things that matter to me, so I do it, but I definitely don't think that it's fair to have it be a replacement for actual activities with other people. You can't really replace that intangible looking someone in the eye or linking arms with them, and so that's kind of how I see it.
But do you think the Internet is sort of a safe zone from state repression, though, because you really... You have a lot more power there, and the government's incapable of really repressing you?
Not at all. I feel like it's a place where severe repression is totally possible. I mean, look at provisions within the USA Patriot Act that allow widespread looking at emails and Internet activity, and you don't even have to be the target of the actual investigation. So it's certainly not a safe zone in any sense of the word, and I hope you're listeners understand that anything that they transmit over email or anything they look at on the internet is definitely being collected somewhere, if nothing else, on your computer. And so it's not a safe zone in that sense. I mean, I guess it's safe if you're doing absolutely nothing wrong and you're doing all above board legal activity that could never be construed as illegal or controversial. Well, sure, then it's a safe zone, but it'd be safe to go out in the street and do that too. So I don't see the internet as a safe zone at all. It's a highly monitored, heavily surveilled zone, and people should be aware of that.
Jules Boykoff, our guest today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Jules is a professor of political science at Pacific University out suburban Portland, Oregon, author of a couple of recent books, last year's The Suppression of Dissent, published by Routledge, and this year AK Press has published Beyond Bullets, both books about the framing of dissent in the media, the suppression of dissent by the state and, as he says, by the mass media. We've only got a few minutes left, Jules, and I do want to ask you, when you teach these courses, and I looked at your website, is there an easy website if listeners want to go check you out?
Sure, you could just go to the school website. It's just pacificu.edu, and you go to the Politics and Government Department. Pretty easy to find me there.
And then Jules Boykoff. Okay, but when you're teaching your students, I see you teach this stuff in your classes. How do your students respond? And then also, do your bosses there, or your peers, your colleagues, a little concerned that this is sort of edgy material you're doing?
Well, you might have to ask my colleagues that. They could tell you better than me, but I feel very supported in my department for sure, and the colleagues I have here give me helpful feedback on what I'm writing, and so I feel very supported. In terms of my students, they're fascinated by it. I mean, they're fascinated by this history, and when I'm talking about this stuff with students, and I want to highlight it today too, I don't talk about this stuff in order to paralyze us and make us feel paranoid and like can't act. On the contrary, I mean, that's my biggest fear when I talk about this stuff, is that it'll put the people in a paralytic state, students included. And what I'm really trying to say is, hey, this is what's happened historically. This is what's out there. This is what's happening. You should be aware of it. I just interviewed a forest activist in Oregon named Kim Marks, a really wonderful forest activist, and I interviewed her for this book you mentioned, and she said this. She says, awareness is two steps ahead, paranoia is two steps behind. And so what I talk about with students is, hey, this is what's happened, and if you're at all interested in any kind of dissent, then you should be aware of these things, and you shouldn't let it stop you. You can be more effective in what you do, whether it's a petition, a totally sanctioned thing, or whatever it is. So,
for listeners who are interested in this issue and really want to do what they can to prevent state suppression of dissidents, are there groups they can look to? Are there websites they can go to? What can they do to not just be paranoid, but to be proactive?
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, there's a really good book out on that topic by a man named Brian Glick. And he wrote a book for South End Press in 1989, and he focuses quite a bit, not just on what I'm talking about, but puts more focus on kind of how to resist and how to sidestep and how to avoid these kind of things. And so I'd recommend his book. I can't remember the title right now, but it's from 1989 from South End Press, Brian Glick. So he breaks it down pretty nicely. And actually, there are a number of people. I mean, Kim Marks, for example, she gives these talks on kind of how to organize effectively. There's also the CLDC, which is a law group. So it's cldc.org, which is a law group based in Eugene, Oregon, that's doing a lot of defense for the so-called Green Scare, which is the charges that have been leveled recently against the Earth Liberation Front in the last year or so.
Well, Jules, at this point I hear the band tuning up in the background. That means that we've got to cut it off here. I'm very sad to say that because I've been enjoying this talk so much. I know our listeners have too. Jules Boykoff, professor of political science at Pacific University, thank you so much for joining us today on Media Matters.
Thank you for having me.
It's been a pleasure. I'm Bob McChesney. I'll be back 167 hours from today. Thank you all for listening. Bye-bye.